Well, I don't know how successful he was, but he is in prison. Basically, it was a front for some kind of sexual trafficking thing he had going on. Had an in-house gospel group called Grace Galaxy. And we're going to hear a little bit before it's time to pass the baton to Devin. This is the Music of Mind Control on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, online at WFMU.org. Here is Grace Galaxy of Jesus Dominion International.
No! You're tuned to WFMU Marconi Island. I'm your host, Devin Livens, here every Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. playing the soundtrack hits. This week is no exception. We have joining us Robert Aiki Aubrey Lowe. We'll be discussing his latest score for Grasshopper Republic, which will be screening here in New York on November 15th at Angelica Theaters, 6:30 p.m. That's a Wednesday, as part of the Docs NYC premiere there. I think there's additional screenings, but the first one we'll have a Q&A with the filmmakers and some special guests. And it's a documentary that was directed by Daniel McCabe, relies on field recordings and natural audio from the remote forests and villages of young men in the forests of Uganda who go to try to trap millions of grasshoppers, which they harvest for the prized delicacy among the city dwellers there. Robert Aiki Aubrey Lowe, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Projects you're involved with kind of came on my radar in the late 90s with 90 Day Men, with that split record with Go 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 Earhart.
Yeah, we were all really close friends, and we would try to play shows together as much as possible, and came up in that split series, asked us to do one together. We were like, yeah, that's a no-brainer. That's so easy.
So you got your start more or less singing for this band, right? Like 90 Day Men and playing bass and even trumpet before?
Yeah, there was a little bit of trumpet playing, and yeah, I played bass and sang in 90 Day Men primarily.
And you guys were based, mostly known out of Chicago, even though kind of originated from St. Louis, right?
Well, all the other members are from St. Louis, and they started the group when Chandler McWilliams and Casey Key were on break from university in Chicago and had come back for the summer, and started the group with Brian Case, who was about to move up to Chicago to go to school. And then I started playing with them just under a year later, just about a year after it started.
Yeah. And so are you from Chicago originally? Or
no, I'm also from Missouri. I'm from Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh, you are.
So I'm from the other city, big city in that state.
But you found each other there, basically.
Yeah. I mean, we knew each other from St. Louis and Kansas City because, you know, we were just playing shows, like house shows or punk shows in different cities in the region. You know, you start to meet people, play shows with people and other bands. And so that's how we all met and kept in contact. And then once they all moved to Chicago, I started playing with them while I was living in Kansas City and ended up moving to Chicago just because it made more sense for me be there. And
but so that band was together for almost 10 years, right? And then at some point you made was it a conscious effort to just do a solo project, or like what drew you to Monophonic Synths and like kind of doing your own thing?
I mean, it was a conscious shift for me. I wanted to be able to explore certain things that I felt were best done on my own, which essentially was exploring the human voice as an instrument. And I like the idea of spontaneous music and ecstatic music. And I felt that I could set up a way myself for me to get there and explore the... And I think I was doing some of that stuff in 90 Day Men. I was back then, and even earlier, I was a really big fan of Yoko Ono. And at that time, Yoko Ono was sort of polarizing. I felt that, you know, there were not a lot of people in my sphere that appreciated the work that she had done. And for me, you know, her work musically, but also her work as a Fluxus artist. And I was very influenced in the way in which she used her voice and her body and found ways to explore gesture and the body in terms of the human voice as an instrument. And so that's sort of where that came from. And then finding other instrumentation that would couple with the voice. You know, early on, I was using acoustic steel string guitar for a lot of the stuff that I was doing, some percussive stuff. And then I ended up landing on modular synthesizers because it was a real foil to the human voice. And I found that a modular synthesizer could also act as a collaborator for me in that space, as well as being an extension of my own body. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of, over time, that's sort of how that developed.
Were you originally attracted to vintage equipment, or was it the newer?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've always been a fan of synthesizers. That, like, I think they're lovely objects. I think they're fascinating in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, vintage instruments initially. But then I found a real love for the cross-pollination of ideas that you found with more contemporary instruments that were pieces of hardware that one person would design, and then you could intermingle that and create a dialogue between two different, completely different concepts,
right.
Which I thought was really exciting. And so, yeah, I really wanted to push the boat out in that way. If I remember correctly, the group Matmos, Drew Daniel and Martin Schmidt, were doing a performance in Manhattan and had asked me to do a performance with them, like as support for mm-hmm. Matmos. I think that's the first time I used the modular synthesizer live.
Where was that?
Is it a place called Le Poisson Rouge?
What drove you into the world of scoring for film? A few years later, it looks like.
Honestly, the first film that I scored was a film called Last Kind Words by Kevin Barker, which is sort of a gothic ghost story that takes place in Kentucky, starring Brad Dourif, which was very exciting for me because I love Brad Dourif. That was 2010, I believe. So before that, some of my work that was available, some of my recordings that were out in the world already had been licensed for short films. The first one was a short film by a filmmaker that was a part of the AFI program, mm-hmm. The American Film Institute program, had made a short film, had heard my work, really liked it, and asked me if he could license it. So that was the first time. And then there were a couple other short films that had licensed pieces of mine, because I do think that the work that I was making back then definitely could lend itself to cinema. Right. And I think a lot of that also had to do with the fact that I was such a fan of cinema from such a young age and was very invested in cinema and discovering films and just being excited about films. And I think the films that I was excited about were a little left of center, things that were more underground, not as readily available. And I think there was the magic of discovery as far as that was concerned as well, whether it was the French New Wave or mid-century Czech animation, you know, and it sort of went on and on. And I would dive as deeply as I could, eventually getting a copy of Amos Vogel's Film as a Subversive Art. That was like the Bible for me, you know, yeah. Being able to explore. At that point, that book was published in 73 or 74, but it only went up to 1972. But it was cinema globally and like different aspects of cinema. And so I would just go through and try to find films that I was reading about in Vogel's book, which that was incredibly beneficial for my education in cinema, aside from the things that I had already discovered up to that point. And that would have been probably around the time that I was 21 years old, maybe.
Well, it looks like in the around 2000, I don't know, 13, 14, 15, you got involved with Johan Johansson and Hildur. Like there's that End of Summer release, the short uh-huh. film. I guess he directed that, right? And then
Johan made the film.
Made the film, and you all contributed instrumentation, I guess.
No, as a trio, we wrote the together. Like that's like all the three of us wrote that work.
How'd that come about? How did you all meet?
Johan and I had been friends for a bit of time. I think we first met in 2008. I was asked to do a couple performances with him, and I think those were his first performances in the U.S. He'd done a small tour. I had been asked to do a performance with him in Philadelphia and one in Chicago. So we did those performances together, and then we just ended up staying in contact. We found that we had a real mutual appreciation for each other's work, and from that point on, sort of talked about what the potential of some sort of a collaboration would look like. So jump forward to, I can't remember when the film Prisoners came out, but Johan had been doing a bit of film scoring, and he had just started talking with Denis Villeneuve about this film Prisoners. So this would have been 2012. The film came out in 2013. And I think Johan's initial idea for making the score was to collaborate with myself and Stephen O'Malley, and the three of us would go to Iceland and make the score for this film. And ultimately, Johan ended up doing that score on his own and going a different direction. I think a lot of it had to do with scheduling between the three of us. But directly after that, he had gone to Antarctica and shot this 16 millimeter footage and was putting, had put together this short film, End of Summer, and had asked me if I would collaborate with him and Hilde to do the score. So I went to Berlin, spent a few days with him and Francesco Donadello, recording engineer in his studio Voxton, and worked on that. And then before I left Berlin, he had mentioned to me that he had been working on another film, and this was another film for Denis called Sicario, and he asked me if I could potentially help with that. And so all of the vocal, all the voice work in Sicario is stuff that I did.
You were part of the one after that too, it was Arrival?
Arrival was a bit more involved on my part. Johan again had started working on Arrival, and this was very early in the process. Denis, I think, was still location scouting at the time that Johan asked me to come to Berlin and start to work on demos with him. So we were talking about these concepts of making a Studer 2-inch tape machine into a giant tape echo, which Francesco had sort of figured out, turning off all the erase heads and then opening up the playback and then making a very long band of 2-inch tape loop, which stretched across the control room and had a microphone stand as a tension for the tape loop. And so I did this series of recordings of my voice. So I figured out I wanted to do these progressions with the voice and this arc. And we had talked a lot about, Johan and I had talked a lot about putting any sort of a, like removing any sort of a cultural reference due to the fact that it was a science fiction film and it was concentrated on the sound of aliens or an alien sound. And so I figured out this progression and this way of moving with my voice, and I created the series of loops that we recorded and then dumped down to Pro Tools, erased the tape. I did it again, dumped it down, erased the tape. And then so we had all the source material to work with. And then Johan also was doing the same thing with the piano. Yeah, there was a grand piano that he was playing these large chords, and the recordings were happening in the same way on the tape loop. And then what they would do is dump all the recordings down to Pro Tools and then remove the attack. So it was just this really large swell. And so between the swells of the piano and the way in which I was sort of arcing my voice, and we had these two elements that were being used as the source material for this main sort of main theme of the film. Those recordings, which were initially meant to be demos, ended up being the actual recordings that were used in the final film.
Thank you.
Were those your last recordings with him? Did you do anything else? Any other collaborations after that?
Then after Arrival, we were meant to work together on Darren Aronofsky's film Mother, which ended up, there was ultimately no score for that film. And then I was working with Johan on another film that didn't happen, but then the final film that we worked on together was Last and First Men, which was his second film.
Oh, right.
Which is a really lovely film of these sort of Tito-era sculptures in the former Yugoslavia. And around that time, I was starting to work on another film I was scoring called Il Corpo del Cane, which is an Italian film made by Fulvio Risolio. Sort of a comedic film, sort of a dark comedy, in a really interesting space for me to exist in due to the nature of the work that I make. But Fulvio had approached me because he really liked my work. And so it was really interesting to approach this film that had a real comedic bent to it and have the ability with the sound to make it even weirder than it already was. So that was really nice. And also when I was in Rome working on the score for that film, I received an email, and this was February of 2019. I received an email from Monkey Paw Productions asking me about my potential interest and availability in scoring a horror film.
How did they find you? Do you know what attracted your music to their project?
All I know is that Jordan Peele and Ian Cooper, who's the artistic director at Monkey Paw, like one of the executives at Monkey Paw, had been fans of my work for some time. And I guess my name had been bandied about a couple times on other projects. And they reached out. And it's funny because they reached out not knowing my relationship to Chicago and not knowing that when I first moved to Chicago, I lived probably
close to
4 to 6 blocks away from Cabrini Green.
Right.
Yeah, really close. They were just compelled to ask me because they thought it would be an interesting proposal for the film. And I agree with them. I think it was pretty interesting.
And we're speaking of the Candyman, the sequel, maybe the fourth.
The
fourth in the series.
Yeah, I mean, it's fourth in the series, but it takes place within the universe of the original film. And I guess it sort of discounts the second and third film and is focused really on the 3 decades down the line after the original film was made by Bernard Rose.
How daunting was that? I mean, all of a sudden you're doing like kind of a big high profile film with the original music for the first one is Philip Glass, the first two, I think. How,
yeah.
I know at the end, the last sequence, which I love, kind of reminds me of Lottie Reiniger's The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, the way the stop animation.
Oh, wow.
If you ever awesome. Have ever seen
that. Yeah.
But I think that may be the only time that you bring back that music box theme, or maybe it does creep in before,
yeah,
but
so
like it's very prominent there. Did you want to? Did you feel compelled to bring that in? How'd you deal with the beast of Philip Glass, I guess, looming over your head?
It was daunting only in the way that it was a high profile project. And I had never dealt with a major studio before, so that was a little bizarre for me. I work generally on a much smaller level, but I'm an artist that's established myself in the way that I do things for many years. And it only makes sense for me to work the way that I work to maintain the integrity of the work that I do. And so I went into the project with a clear proposal of how I wanted to approach the film, with clear intentions of the things that I wanted to make, how I wanted to make them, which were very unconventional. And I said that up front. I'm a very unconventional composer. I do things in a very strange way. Nothing is traditional. And you need to know that because that's how I'm going to do it. And that's what's going to make the most sense. And I'm going to make sure that it makes the most sense within this landscape, because ultimately, the work that I do is meant to enhance the vision of the filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And so it was about having communication, like having deep dialogues and a back and forth where we could create a vocabulary of our own, myself and Nia DaCosta, the director, but also having conversations with Ian and Jordan and having this understanding of like, okay, I'm going to present this work and I'm doing so in this way with this very clear intention. And I will explain to you why I'm doing things the way that I'm doing them, because this is how I see my way through it. It's the most important thing for me within the scope of a collaboration like that, is to make sure that the communication is very strong and there's an open dialogue. And for me, it's always important to come onto the project as early as I possibly can, because that means that I have the ability to give the most complex, most advanced version of the thing that I need to make in that space, period. Going into it, there were conversations initially about the original score, because at the time it seemed quite different that someone like Philip Glass would do a score for a horror movie. Or at least that was sort of the way it was perceived. It seems to have been perceived in that way. It was important for me, and I said this many times, I said it's really important for me to make sure that people understand that this film, even though it is a spiritual sequel to the original film, is its own film. It takes place within the universe of the original film, but it needs to stand on its own as an independent work. That being said, not only the film itself has to be that, but every aspect of that film, so the score as well. So there were talks about the potential of utilizing some aspects of the original score, which I sort of pushed off to the side. And it was most important for me to be able to create the world, like build the world, create the sound palette, understand the instrumentation that I wanted to be using in that space, and not have it be beholden to the original score, which I think is amazing work. I'm a huge fan of Philip Glass, and I have been since I discovered his work as a teenager. Love it. It's bananas good. But I felt that it would be reductive to give too much. And it was about understanding how to make references to those things without things being derivative. And so I built this whole body of work, this complete score. And then for a very specific scene, which was ultimately a flashback scene, in which early on in the film, which you see the shadow puppet animation, I then started to explore the music box theme. And then due to the fact that I had already created the world of sound that the score was living in and the character that was then imparted to the film itself, then I was able to explore that composition and make it my own and make it make sense within the context of the larger score that I had made.
The very end, you bring it back in kind of like full force, but it still has all these elements of like what you've been creating leading up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing notable, and I don't know how important this is for all of your films, but you had actually went to Cabrini Greens and did field recordings, right?
It's true, yeah.
Was that during the filming of this, or this on your own, or, uh-huh. or separately?
No, it was during the shoot. It was important for me, and I had also expressed this to them early on, even before I had been selected to make the score for the film. I said it would be important for me to be on location because, for a number of reasons. One, to do field recordings, which was the most important reason, because I wanted to take the psychic energy of the space, the actual space, which ultimately ended up being the core theme of the film, was not the theme of a person. It was the location. The theme was more tethered to the location of Cabrini Green. So I wanted to be able to do field recordings in and around the row houses because the high rises, the towers don't exist anymore. They were torn down. To capture that psychic energy and impart that as textural elements inside of the score itself. So that energy and that physicality of that three-dimensional space was actually then injected into the score and carries that energy throughout. So yes, that was an important
thing. Is there a specific track you can recall that most exemplifies that?
There are a few. I would say I also did recordings of some of the actors' voices. And another reason for being on location was actually to be able to watch Nia work as a director and how she worked in that space and how she worked with the actors in the space. And it was important for me to understand her practice as an artist as well. But I did some recordings of some of the main characters of the film, and I prompted them with very specific words or phrases related to the film, one being the incantation of Candyman, and took and granularly stretched and mangled those voices to the point that they were no longer recognizable as human voices or language, and also injected that into the space and that idea of having the incantation of Candyman in these compositions where you don't actually hear it or understand it as being that, but the energy of that thing is in that space. So I think Rosen Towers is a good example of that. The End of Finley is also a good
example of that, right?
Last summer, I did see Telemarketers, you know, on HBO. That was like a three-part docuseries, I recall. And then more recently, just coming out now, Grasshopper Republic. Both of these available through Invada,
Invada Records, yeah.
And you've had a premiere for Grasshopper Republic, like the world premiere, but coming up here in New York for Docs NYC, I guess November 15th, you have the first New York screening, if not U.S. screening. You can tell me otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It's Angelica Theater, 6:30 p.m., Angelica Theater, Village East. And there will be an in-person.
But will you be there for the Q&A? Or?
I will be there for the Q&A, yeah. We're definitely doing the Q&A for the Angelica screening, which is the first one. And then it'll screen at IFC the next day, but there won't be a Q&A. So if you have the opportunity, come to the Angelica. But in general, if you have the opportunity to see the film in the cinema, I highly recommend it.
It's the best way, always.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that it's a documentary filmed in Uganda, in the forests of Uganda, and it's a number of people that are basically trapping grasshoppers that are a delicacy, it sounds like. And it sounds like it's more a meditative type documentary where you're seeing the workings of these people, the beginnings, I guess, the births of some of these grasshoppers, and less dialogue and more visual with your music as a counterpart to all that. I can only assume, based on the Candyman discussion, that you had some field recordings going with that project as well.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's a pretty accurate description. So basically, Grasshopper Republic is a documentary about grasshopper trapping in Uganda. But the thing about Grasshopper Republic is it doesn't necessarily read as a documentary. And that's the thing that I really love about it. It's meant to be experiential. It's meant to be immersive. And there's nothing explained. There's no exposition. There's no narration or voiceover. There's no
interviews.
And the humans within the landscape of the film are not only not interacting with the camera, they don't acknowledge the camera ever in the film. And I think in a way, the way I came into working on this film was Daniel McCabe, the director, reached out to me through social media, actually, and said, "Hey, I am a fan of your work. I had recently seen you do this performance a few months ago, and I have this film that I'm working on, and I was wondering if you might potentially be interested in doing a score." And so he sent me also a 3-minute sizzle, which I responded to him immediately and said, "Thank you for sending this." And I was in the middle of some other work, and I said, "When I get a moment to actually have the brain space to take a look at this, I will." And so a few days later, I took a look at this 3 minutes of footage that was shot in Uganda, and it blew my mind. It was so incredibly expansive, this 3 minutes of footage. I was longing to see more of it, and immediately thought, "Oh yeah, this is something that I would love to be involved with." But you know, it's an interesting situation because it is a white American filmmaker that's making this film about this part of Ugandan culture. But the thing that I love about the film is the way in which it's made, the way in which it's cut together. You know, it's a film that was 3 years in the making. Mm. It took them 3 years to make this film and get the footage. So it's 280 plus hours of footage that the editor, Elise Ardell-Spiegel, had to sift through to get to it. Because the first year they went during grasshopper season, the swarm season, they didn't get the swarm. They went back a second year during swarm season. They didn't get the swarm. They went back the third year and they got it. And this grasshopper swarm happens on a biblical level. It's bananas. It just fills up the sky.
It's difficult to actually capture it.
Well, I think there are specific locations in the forests and around lake systems in Uganda where the swarms generally tend to happen, but it's about timing. It's about finding the right time, being able to build the trap, which is a real ordeal. Like it's a long process because, you know, these traps for the grasshoppers end up being the size of like a small village.
Oh,
like
geez.
It's a lot of people working in this space, collecting all these grasshoppers, and then they bag up burlap sacks, like millions of these grasshoppers, throw them on top of vans, drive into Kampala, the main city, and by dawn, they're at the market selling them. So the process is really wild, and it happens in a very short period of time. But then, of course, the lead up to that is an extended period. But the way in which the film works, there's something about it that at one moment leans away from the concept of a documentary because you're just an observer in this landscape. And in a way, there's something that reminds me of the movement of people working, that series, that film series that Phil Niblock had been working on for years. But it lends itself to slow cinema. So something by Ben Rivers or Ben Russell or Steve McQueen or Apichatpong Resetthakul or even like Chantal Ackerman, the depth and the stillness of the way in which the film moves until it doesn't. And then it becomes this ecstatic experience. But it's something that's really lovely. And like the dialogue that happens, it's very, like, not mundane, but it truly is like very casual, very natural. You're watching this process, but also you're seeing it from the vantage point of the insect world as well. Mm-hmm. So it's about this sort of push and pull between the human world and the insect world. And for me, it was really interesting to explore a concept of almost science fiction, which is something that Dan and I had been discussing quite a lot as I was coming to make the score, and finding themes or sonic articulations that would lend themselves to the insect world, and then also different articulations that were maybe more tonal in scope for the human world, and then having the cross-pollination of those two things. So if it was more tonal in the human world, maybe it was more textural or potentially percussive in the insect world, and like having those things intermingle and elementally finding those things in the other world as well. So it was about sort of moving through the landscape and finding how to represent the spaces explored in the film in this sonic or aural function.
You have a long period of time to work on that? Like, were you within all these different attempts for them to film it, or did you come in more towards the end?
I came in after everything had been filmed. The first footage I saw that was cut together was, I saw a 5-hour cut. That was the first thing that they sent to me. So they were still really working through a lot of footage. But soup to nuts, I probably spent 6 months altogether.
Were you able to get grasshopper sound? Do they make noise?
They do. And it was actually interesting for me to steer clear of the actual diegetic sound and let the diegetic sound exist in the space as it was, and then find moments in the score where elementally you would have this sort of echo of a diegetic sound that you would hear. So then it's about playing with this concept of reality versus fantasy or reality versus illusion, where you don't know if that was a synthesizer or a voice that made that sound, or if that was actually something that happened in the diegetic sound in nature. And I really like playing with that. I tend to do that a lot in the scores that I make for film, because I find that very interesting. And I really enjoy the idea of letting go and letting the film take up all the room mm-hmm. around you while it's there and while it has your attention. And to be able to find different ways to excite the ear, whether it's using psychoacoustics or just playing with the sound in the room in a surround space or in an Atmos, you know, things like that. So yeah, I did not touch any of the diegetic sound because it was so insanely rich. But it was also interesting to find where to let go of the score altogether and let the diegetic sound blossom, and then find spaces in which the two were intermingled, and then find also spaces of silence within the film, like all of these things. It's about crafting these arrangements with the visual and the aural, like in the sonic, at all times throughout the process of making the work.
Yeah, I imagine you're rubbing up against a lot of the diegetic sound and the sound design or whatever. You know, it's sometimes hard to tell what is what, and that's kind of what makes it interesting.
Thank you.
I also don't want to overlook, because it's fresh, The Telemarketers. Yeah. That release was just a few months ago.
Yeah.
Have it overshadowed, but that was an HBO production that you were involved with. And the Safdie brothers were executive producers for it, right?
Yeah, the Safdie brothers and Danny McBride and David Gordon Green.
And David Gordon Green, right.
Bugs. Yeah.
How'd you get involved with that one? They're also different, you know, coming from Candyman.
They're
into
very different.
Telemarketers and then Grasshoppers Republic.
Yeah. Once again, they approached me. I got an email from the editor, Chris Pasek, who is someone that I know. He's an excellent editor. He's been working in film and television for many years. And he tends to use a lot of my work as temp music as he's cutting things together. And he found, and the directors and producers found, that they were enjoying the work of mine that was temporary, and the cuts that and the edits that Chris was making. And so they reached out and asked me if I would potentially be interested in doing score. When they explained to me what it was, I was like, oh, this sounds really interesting. Chris had just finished cutting the first rough cut of the first episode when they had reached out to me. So they sent that to me to watch. And I was like, oh, this is a really compelling space to be in. And I became excited about, and it was also my first foray into television. I had not done any television thus far, which is a very different animal than film. But it was a very enjoyable one. It was sort of getting my footing was a little different due to the fact that it operates in a different way. And there was, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that cuts would sort of move back and forth. And I think due to the legal aspects of certain material within the cuts, like things had to be moved around just so everyone was covered legally, even down to how things were phrased, how they were said. There was a lot of back and forth, but it was a really lovely space to work in between Chris and Claire Reed, who is the lead producer, and Adam Balalo and Sam Lipman Stern, the two directors. It was a very easy space to exist in because it was very familial and everyone was very supportive in every aspect of the making of that show. I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that it is a show about camaraderie as much as it is a PSA about criminal, you know, scams, like telemarketing scams. It's about friendship. It's about camaraderie. It's about two people really getting into it and doing something together. I got to play around with things that I normally don't play around with in those landscapes. It's things that would honestly lean more into song forms than I have generally with other scores that I've done, which are a little more peculiar. And I think the weirdness of the things that I make is very present and very apparent in the Telemarketer's score, but it's just a different sonic landscape and it's a slightly different approach. But
why do you think? What made you go that direction?
I think it just had to do with what I felt suited the story, how it arced and how things moved, how things were propelled through space. Documentaries are different than narrative films, and you know, a docuseries like this, I don't know, there's a lot of push and pull in how it moved, but I mean, it moved very fluidly. And I think that's really due to Chris's editing job, which was really stellar. The way he cut that show together was bananas.
I guess I should have said this on the onset, that the Telemarketers is a docuseries, but it's based on two coworkers or two friends.
Yeah, two coworkers at the time.
At the time, were just feeling like they couldn't believe all the stuff the employees were getting away with at work, whether it was doing drugs.
Exactly.
And they were just filming all the stuff that went on during the day. And then they slowly start to learn that these police charities, and I think fire as well, charities that they were collecting money for and duping people in, were actually going to the pockets of the owners.
The owners of
CDG
the company.
CDG. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a long period of time, right?
Yeah, it's over the course of 20 plus years, honestly. And yeah, so it was basically Sam Lipman Stern, who is one of the directors, he's the person that initially started bringing a video camera to work and recording things. And then he befriended Patrick J. Pespis, who is one of his coworkers, and was really excited about sort of making a character study of Pat, so making a film about Pat. And then it shifted from that point as they became closer as friends, where Pat started talking more about how criminal things were that they were doing, and Sam started to see it as well, you know, and especially when it shifted from being a shill for the Fraternal Order of the Police to raising funds for cancer patients that who knows if they're actually getting that money. That's, I think, where they it really started to twist, and they really sort of became these gonzo journalists. And this sort of Verite series explores that whole landscape, which is pretty, it's a wild ride.
Yeah.
And it was a total pleasure to work on, like every moment.
They go further than they probably ever imagined, like speaking to senators,
yeah,
politicians, and trying absolutely to get further along.
I was really excited when this series came out. It seemed like it tracked with a lot of people. People really responded positively to it. And I think it's due to the fact that it's a story that's told in a very natural way. It's a subject matter that if you yourself had not worked as a telemarketer, you know someone else that had worked in some sort of a call center. Hmm. So there's that relationship to it, coupled with this vampiric relationship that every single person has with telemarketing, because we get scam calls and robocalls every single day. So I think having those relationships and also showing the camaraderie of these two people going through the motions to sort of sound the alarm and become whistleblowers about this subject matter, I think people, it really resonated with people because it's very earnest, it's very real.
Is there anything else you're working on the film side of things or otherwise that you're able to talk about or on the horizon?
I've just finished working on a documentary with Yancey Ford called Power, which is about the history of policing. It's a real gut punch.
How important is it for you to get, I guess, soundtrack releases for these? Do you push for them, or they just kind of naturally happen? Or
I push for them because I feel that the work that I make, it being that it's intentional in the space of cinema or the space of this visual medium, I make things that I think are able to stand on their own as an independent work. And so I also like having that juxtaposition of having it with the film and then having it without the film, because I think then I am very keen on making sure that the packaging is the way that it needs to be. I tend to ultimately micromanage the way these things are made, because that intention carries through to the object of the release, or even the digital. I always want to have a hand in the cover art, the layout,
right.
You know, make sure everything is as it should be. But it is always really important.
Yeah. I imagine it's so labor intensive, and also your ultimate work may get chopped up a little bit, or it may be quiet the dialogue or whatever. It gets, I would imagine you want it to be out there and kind of stand on its own and be heard.
Yes, exactly.
With all the time and energy and effort you've put into to creating it, mm-hmm. to get it out there in the world. I thank you so much for your time and willingness to come on. And
yeah, thanks for having me. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Yeah,
take care.
Bye.
WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, broadcasting at 91.9 FM in New York City and Rockland County, and online at WFMU.org. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Well, good evening to you out there. My name is Scott McDowell. This program is called The Long Rally, filling in for Jesse Jarno tonight and the wonderful Frau Show, typically heard Tuesdays 9 to midnight. I'll be here for the next 3 hours, finishing up your Tuesday election day here on the airwaves of WFMU, broadcasting along the eastern seaboard of Jersey City, New Jersey, to the world at 91.1 FM, WFMU.org. Welcome to the program. And thanks to Jesse for having me fill in this week. Got a bunch of stuff to play for you, carefully selected. And we're going to start off the program today with music from Carla Bley. Carla Bley, jazz composer, arranger, and provocateur, passed away at age 87 on October 17th. And she lived a full life, that's for sure. Amazing composer. Amazing figure in the world of jazz, starting in the early to mid 60s. And really part of the whole crew that was going on in New York in the mid 60s, the Jazz Composers Orchestra, Jazz Composers Guild, hanging out.